No Direction and Paizo team up to bring you the Gen Con 2018 seminar coverage. No Direction would like to thank our advertising sponsor, the Roll for Combat Starfinder Actual Play Podcast. Listen at rollforcombat.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Gen Con. I am Mark Moreland. I am Paizo's franchise manager, which means that I make sure that everyone who's doing anything that's branded Pathfinder or Starfinder is consistent with each other from a branding and continuity perspective. So that's a little job. And up here with me...
I'm Eleanor Farron. I am a developer on the Pathfinder line, which means that I write all of the stuff that Mark needs to keep track of when making sure that everybody keeps everything consistent with each other.
I'm Luis Loza. I am also a developer on the Pathfinder line. We work specifically on the campaign setting lines and player companion lines, so we help get more options and world material out there for you.
Okay, and this panel is the World of Pathfinder.
Introduction to the World
of Pathfinder. So really, we're going to, a lot of it will be Q&A for folks who have questions. First, though, I want to ask, who here has never played a game in Galarian? Two. Yes, our creative director, Sarah, over here. Who, yeah, thank you. Not supposed to admit to that. Okay, so a few folks. How many of you do use pre-written or pre-made campaign settings, whether from Paizo or from other... Yeah, okay. And then how many of you just primarily do homebrew settings? Okay. All right, Sarah does just homebrew settings. She has the most elaborate one ever. You'd never believe it. Okay, so why don't we start with just an overview of what the Pathfinder setting is that... I don't know which one of you wants to tackle that.
Sure, we can... How far back are we talking in terms of where we're starting? Or is it just a...
Yeah, okay, so let's talk about an overview of the basic timeline from... We'll say go back 10,000 years.
In the beginning.
So our setting, Galarian, is a nice, big, high fantasy world like you're used to with a lot of other more fantasy-themed RPGs. There's obviously a lot that makes it distinct, though. One of the first big things is that it's at least 10,000 years old, at least with recorded history as we know it in our setting, in which... Is that Earthfall? Was that around Earthfall?
Yeah.
So... 10,000 years ago, let's say, a giant big death meteor fell to the sky because some more than unhappy aboleths were hanging out in the ocean and decided those humans sure feel high and mighty about themselves. Let's knock them down a peg, and decided let's pull this meteor down from space, and that'll show them. And it tended to destroy a lot more than anyone had expected.
Yeah, it wasn't just one meteor that came down. It was a whole rain. So the event is generally called Earthfall. It was basically the reset button on recorded history. All of the existing empires were pretty much knocked back to square one. And Reign of Stars is what they called it as the actual event in the time.
And right after that, everything kind of went dark. It was a really rough time for all of the different races on Galarian. It's known as the Age of Darkness. For a while, people even forgot how to do magic. And over time, over these last 10,000 years or so, humanity and elvenkind and dwarves and everyone have slowly started rising up again and reclaiming the world from themselves. And... we have different events based on all these different races. For example, the elves kind of just left Galarian for a while. They went back home to their other planet where they're originally from. The dwarves...
Spoilers. They went to a place called Severian in a mysterious realm that happens to be their neighboring planet, Castrovel. The elves had a series of teleportation gates called the... Ayudara in Elven, which everyone else just calls Elf Gates. And they were all able to amass together in their capital city of Iadara, similar to Ayudara. Not a coincidence.
Meanwhile.
And then they left for Severian, so they said, things are not going well here, so we're jumping ship. Dwarves weren't even around. Where were dwarves when Earthfall happened?
They were hanging around underground, and then they heard this loud, big commotion up above them. Like, what is that? There's an above the ground?
Yeah. Oh, remember that prophecy that our god, Torag, who created us and gave us the forge and all of the great things that we love down here in the darkness? Remember how he said that he would give us a sign and then we would need to do the quest for Sky? Do you think that was it?
I don't know. Let's go, though. That's probably it.
So that's what they did. So they began the quest for Sky back then. I'll get to you in just a second. And on their way there, it was a completely smooth journey, mm-hmm. no opposition whatsoever,
yep.
right?
Yep, perfect. Everyone loved every single second of it, except maybe the orcs. They didn't care
for
that.
Oh, yeah, the orcs who lived above them, who didn't really like them coming through and, you know, building highways across their territory. So they sort of battled the orcs all the way up to the surface, all pushed them out, and so both orcs and dwarves came to the surface shortly after this time into this world that was in turmoil because it had been wrecked by a meteor shower. And we had a question out in the audience. How do meteors make you forget how to do magic? It was less that they forgot how to do magic, but all of the centers of learning, in the same way that in the real world, the Dark Ages sort of came as a result of the fall of Rome, and these pillars of civilization were reduced to ruins, and then knowledge was lost, and those systems of government and innovation that had lasted for who knows how long prior to that were basically reset because they didn't have stable trade. Their agriculture was wrecked because they weren't getting, you know, weather patterns changed. Whole continents were sunk into the sea because they were battered by meteors and things. So, magic became a thing that needed to be rediscovered. Discoveries that had previously been made needed to be rediscovered in the same way that in the real world, you know, mathematics and astronomy that the ancient Greeks had done had to be rediscovered in the Renaissance.
So they aren't magic-forgetful
meteors. Yes, no, they're not magical-forgetful meteors.
At least not that we know of.
Yeah, no, although that could be a cool adventure of a meteor hitting and then people really forgetting magic.
They are, in fact, magical meteors, but they don't...
They are magical meteors. So one meteor in particular was very magical.
Mm-hmm. That's that really big one.
Well, it was part of the really big one.
What they call it the Star Stone now. Mm-hmm. And it crash-landed. If you see here, this big strip in the middle of the ocean there, known as the Inner Sea... that was created by the Star Stone as it, part of the big meteor and everything that was happening.
Yeah.
Crashed along here and tore open the land so much that it created a new sea. And right there, that island on the far right is about where it landed. And
well, beneath there. Yeah.
Beneath there, yeah.
Way down there.
It and sunk
so that,
down there.
That was all just one big ocean for about 4,000, or no, almost 6,000 mm-hmm. years, actually. So other nations had risen. There was civilization here in what is now Tal'Dor, where the refugees of Aslant, which is sort of our Atlantis analog, the primary high culture that was destroyed by the meteor storm, the ones whose hubris pissed off the Aboleth so much. The refugees and survivors of that nation sort of settled there, and they started rebuilding a new nation down here on the bottom left of the map. As you can see, is Osirian. That's where people again began to experiment with magic, and they were ruled by wizard kings who built giant pyramids to themselves and to the glory of their god Nethys and things like that. And then suddenly, in the year one, they started a new way of counting called the Absalom Reckoning calendar. And why did they do that?
Remember that big old meteor thing that had fallen down into the ocean created? Someone went and picked it up.
Oh!
Scooped it all up.
Scooped it up?
Yeah, this nice, cool Aslanti guy named Aridin.
But that was 6,000 years earlier. What do you mean, Aslanti guy?
Oh, he's the last Aslanti.
Oh, so he was immortal?
He was something special.
Oh, yeah, there he is. There's Aridin.
Something special. He used his great power to raise the Starstone up from the ocean, up from the sea there, and in turn, in doing so, became a god.
So wait, he just that stone made him a god?
Yeah, it's that powerful. It's that magical.
Huh. And now it's just sitting there, right?
It's on that island that he raised, and there's a nice big cathedral that's been built around it. Oh. And if you happen to go and visit it, you could become a god yourself. Yeah. Well, the thing is, when you go to the cathedral, the Starstone itself puts a challenge forth to prove your worth, to see if you can become a god. And very, very, very few people have ever succeeded.
Other than
on that.
Yeah, three. Yeah, other than Aridin, three people have succeeded and become gods by going through the test of the Starstone.
And who were these people?
Oh, okay, yeah. These people were Aridin's herald, which is sort of the right hand of the god, the one who, while the god is inscrutable and up in the planes doing things, that comes down and interacts with mortals so that, you know, the gods themselves aren't walking around, but their big, powerful outsider minions are. His herald, whose name was Iomide, she was a human who was a crusader and had fought wars on Aridin's behalf. She took the test and became her own god. There was Caden Kalian, who was a drunken adventurer on a dare. When he was really plastered, he went and, I guess, took the test of the Starstone. He woke up the next day a god, but didn't really remember what happened. And so he is the god of luck and
freedom.
Freedom and alcohol and bravery. Yeah. So a lot of adventurers like him. And then there's Norgorber. People don't really know who Norgorber was before he became a god. He is the god of secrets. He's the god of assassins, of poison yeah. of thievery. His own identity is really shrouded in mystery, and so of the four ascended gods, he is the one that we know the least about. Mm-hmm. What are things like for Aridin now?
Pretty quiet.
Oh. What's that?
Last we heard, Aridin was supposed to show up about 100 years ago.
Oh.
Yeah, there was a big prophecy that says, Aridin's going to go out, do some stuff. You know, come back, and then everything's going to be great. Humans are going to be the greatest thing ever. And then everything went wrong?
Yeah,
everything went wrong.
Yeah.
Aridin didn't show up. Uh-huh. Anyone who was a worshiper of Aridin, his clerics and his priests, stopped receiving his divine powers.
Oh.
They can't cast any spells or do any healing or anything like that. And it seems like he's dead.
Oh. Well, I'm sure that that's not a big deal, right?
Well, when he died, the giant hurricane showed up and started destroying part of a continent. Uh-huh. And a whole rend in the world appeared and tore open and demons started spilling forth. And
okay. All right.
Typical stuff.
Yeah, so what we've hit upon here is one of the central themes of the setting, which is the god Aridin.
Which is show up on time or horrible things happen.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so Aridin is really the through line of history and played a role in some of the most major events in the setting. Mm-hmm. You know, he was the last survivor of the apocalypse of Earthfall. Who lived thousands of years after all of the rest of the Aslanti died off and, you know, interbred and just became a diluted bloodline with all the other races. He raised the Starstone and in doing so created the Isle of Kortos and the city of Absalom around it. He just created the city whole cloth because you can't have something that turns you into a god without a city around it. He, as a mortal prior to doing that, fought many battles. He fought against a tyrannical wizard named Tarbafon, who he killed. Mm-hmm. And then he became a god and still sort of hung around with mortals. He lived in Absalom. He used to walk the earth in the guise of... Is it 7 or 9?
I thought it was 12.
Oh, 12. You're right. Yeah. As 12 different personas. So the farmer and
the beggar
and all this. And so he sort of, as the god of humanity, he took on these different roles. He sort of made sure that humanity remained the preeminent race of people on the planet. And then he fought the demon Lord Descari, who's a big locust demon, mm-hmm. And drove him into the sea. And then he was like, you know what? I'm getting sort of tired of all of this wandering. I'm going to go off and be a god, and I'll come back in a few years. And then he didn't show up. And since then, the world has really been thrown into turmoil because he was really the foundational god of this region. You know, he created the city at the center of the world, and now there's hurricanes and the world wound, and nations that once worshipped him are thrown into civil war, and it's utter chaos. Good thing there's the PCs to come along and fix stuff. So that's sort of where we are now and how the dead god Aridin sort of plays a role. Since he died, prophecy hasn't worked the way it was supposed to. So things that people thought were going to come to pass...
Like Aridin showing up
or other stuff just don't work. So people who believed that they were destined for greatness may find themselves challenged more than they normally would have been, and people who otherwise would have had no destiny before them are making their own destiny, and that's really that really lays the foundation for player characters, to tell big stories that have the potential to change the world.
So what's the rest of the world like?
What's the rest of the world like?
Today.
Eleanor, do you want to talk about the other parts of the world?
Where would you like me to start?
Start at the top.
We have the crown of the world. At the top of the world, unsurprisingly.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's pretty cold up there.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, not really, a place you want to visit in the spring or fall or winter or uh-huh. anything. But if you want to go all the way through there and try not to be eaten by a polar bear or any number of things that might be up there, you can get all the way to a continent known as Tian Sha.
Oh, Tian Sha, okay. That's on the opposite side of the world. What's it like there?
Well, the place you come out is full of these guys that ride around on horses, and they're not very friendly. But they do like it if you bring stuff for them to buy.
Okay.
So as long as you stay on the roads and sell stuff, you'll probably be okay. But otherwise, you're probably going to get run over by horse people.
Okay. You mean centaurs?
No, people on horses.
Okay, okay. So, like, hordes of
yeah, you might,
barbarians.
You might say
yeah.
hordes
yeah.
that
okay.
hoard things.
Okay, okay. Cool. Uh-oh, how do you spell those? Okay, yeah, and so that's sort of, in terms of real-world analogs, what that would be the Far East, that would be Asia?
Yeah.
Okay.
Far East with, like, a sort of an oversized Japan off to that side.
Yes, it's true. It's the Minkai, which is our Japan.
The Philippines are kind of stuck on at the bottom, and I think there's some Naga.
Yeah, there's
India,
a Naga nation.
Just sort of stuck
down there. Yeah. So, but that is the region where if you want to play a ninja or a samurai or, some of the more.
A giant bird person.
Like.
Fox-headed person.
Oh yeah, Kitsune. Yeah, that sort of stuff. They're all from there. There's a race of people who, when they die, just are constantly reincarnated, called the Samsarans, that live there as well. So we took a lot of the real world mythology of Asia, well, Eastern Asia, not so much Central or Middle Eastern Asia, but the Eastern stuff, and put that in there. So there's Kami and Penanglins and Monongonals and things I can't pronounce.
Onis
so
out your ears.
What?
Oni out your ears.
Yes, yeah, so Oni out your ears. Yeah, lots of Oni. Yeah, so that's where the ninjas and the samurais are from. What's the other direction from the inner sea? If you're not going west, or is there anything in between?
Yes.
This region and
it's quite a bit.
Okay.
If you remember the Aslanti, they were hanging out. They had their own nice little land where they were living, which got completely destroyed and torn apart.
Right.
So a lot of islands along the way in the ocean with ancient ruins of Aslanti and other big secrets. And if you go past that, you end up in Arcadia, mm-hmm. which is this enormous continent that is kind of our America's analog of North and South America, in which we have... some stuff that not many people get out there yet.
Yeah, we haven't really developed that part of the world as much as others yet. We've got several people, Luis included, on staff, Adam Daigle being the other one, who are really keen on getting the spotlight shown on that part of the world. So perhaps in the near future.
Pretty near future, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, definitely, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Do you want to tell them where to look for more on that, or have we not revealed that yet?
We've said a little bit. There's going to be a point in an adventure coming up within the next year that visits one of the regions in Arcadia in the future. I'll keep it at that. Just if you're looking for that kind of information, look in our adventure pass pretty soon.
Sorry.
I know we threw in a bunch of pictures of different regions. If maybe we can look at some of those and just say, look, here's a spot in...
Yeah, so why don't we explain
like,
what some
great,
of these
great
are.
Start.
we've got about 10 minutes here before I'd like to open it up to questions. Yeah. So let's go through that. While I text my wife back and let her know why I didn't pick up the phone, if you guys want to go through and sort of explain what these images are of.
So these guys look very excited to see this big chicken hut chasing after them. We're looking at a region known as Irisin, in which a caste of witches, known as the Winter Witches, rule. And they are directly related to the line of Baba Yaga, one of the many creatures and characters that we pull from mythology to kind of spruce up our world here. So they're in a land of eternal winter, in which all the witches have things like these dancing huts that they go around and
no, use. No, just the one dancing hut.
The one dancing. There's the one dancing hut.
Yeah, because Baba Yaga needs
just
a place
just
to
Baba Yaga dancing. Excuse me, sorry. They have lots of power, lots of magic power that they use to kind of keep their icy grasp upon the land.
All right, next.
This is Last Wall. Earlier we mentioned Tar Bafon, that really tyrannical wizard. He died, but really powerful wizards tend to not stay dead. And this one came back as a lich.
Yeah, cockroaches.
Yes, and cockroaches. Yes, the two most powerful things in Galarian. Came back as a lich, and eventually many crusaders, including some that were led by Iomade, fought against Tar Bafon and were eventually able to defeat him, not destroy him, but defeat him, and he's currently locked up in a vault way below the ground.
At least for another 6 months.
Under a structure known as Gallowspire. And because they were so worried that he might break free again, an entire nation was established just to keep an eye out in case he was doing anything. And this is Lastwall. This is some of the crusaders of Lastwall who are always ready to fight against the menace of the undead that are around that region.
You want to talk about this one?
Mendev in the world?
Or you want to leave it to Luis?
Well, so we may have mentioned that Aradin was late, and because he was late...
No, he died.
No, he was just late. Okay. He's going to show up any minute now.
Yes, okay. I believe it.
Clap your hands if you believe in Aradin. In a lesson on punctuality, Aradin was late, and because he was late, a rift opened up in this country, and like a billion demons started pouring out. So that was bad. And the people around that decided that maybe they didn't want a billion demons getting out, you know, and just sort of spreading like mold. Once you get them in, you can't get them out. So much like last fall, an entire nation just sort of, you know, got some crusaders together and went and decided they were going to kill all these demons. But, you know, there's like a billion of them, so they're still at it today. And if you want to kill a billion demons, we have an adventure path for you known as Wrath of the Righteous.
That's
where
true.
Where you can join this crusade.
Yes.
And kill a billion demons. And
similarly, if you want to deal with the Winter Witches, there's also the Reign of Winter.
The Winter Witches, yeah, are in Reign of Winter.
That's a robot.
It's a giant scorpion robot.
Giant scorpion robot that fell from the sky. And look, there's a spaceship in the background, and this barbarian sure seems upset.
No, he looks like that's a challenge that he is up for.
Oh, he's upset because it looks like his lunch got interrupted.
Well, he's upset because yeah. he's a barbarian, and that's just sort of their internal state of mind.
Yeah, it's true. So, thousands of years ago, as things tend to happen, another thing fell from the sky. This is an enormous something or other. No one knows what it is. It's really strange. We've never seen anything like it in the world.
Yeah.
A big mechanical object fell from the sky and created this thing known as the Silver Mount, and spilling forth from it was all this amazing technology that no one had ever seen in Galarian before. Things like laser guns and grenades and robots and giant robotic scorpions.
And pools of nanites that'll just strip you to the bone or create a robot that then attacks you and then creates another robot that attacks you and another robot that attacks you.
It happened to
as
fall.
As nanites are wont to do.
It happened to fall in a land known as Gamaria that was chock full of barbarians who said, yeah, let's break those things too. And now in that region, Gamaria, there's a lot of people who've used this technology to further their own agendas, and we have a whole city known as
Starfall.
I almost called it Skyfall. That's wrong. Starfall, where, you know, technology reigns supreme, and people still make expeditions into the Silver Mountain, you know, try to find more technology, and sometimes it comes and finds you.
Yeah. Do we have an adventure path that's related to that one?
If you would like to be a very angry barbarian that wants to smash some giant super robots, we have an adventure path called Iron Gods for you.
Okay. All right. Let's keep going.
So just north of
Verisia,
just neighbor to Irisin, the land of the Winter Witches. We have the lands of the Linorm Kings, and here we have
another barbarian.
A prospective Linorm King. Fighting said Linorm.
No, you pronounced it wrong. It's Linorm Dinner.
Linorm, yes. So it's a land that's very much inspired by things like Vikings and Norse mythology, in which it's filled with these terrible dragons known as Linorms. And it's broken up into several, tribes, city-states.
It's not
a proper nation. It's more just an area where a lot of people hang out and
fight Linorms.
And if you wanted to be your own Linorm king, you could challenge a Linorm and try to earn that title.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter who you are, you can be a Linorm king.
You could be a Linorm queen.
They're called Linorm Kings, though.
Yes, White Estrid is a female Linorm King, however.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, no big deal. Just fight this whole big dragon on your own. No help. You can do it. We believe in you.
And, yeah, so far they've all killed them. One of them claims to have killed one, but no one can prove him wrong. But maybe he didn't. And White Estrid, the one I mentioned before, she didn't kill the Linorm. She tamed it. So she's got that sitting there by her throne now, and that's our Viking land.
Mm-hmm.
Come from the land of the Isles.
And speaking of kings and things like that, we also have Tal'Dorei, which is one of our big, more intrigue kind of themed. With lots of nobility and royalty, that backstabbing, things like that kind of nations.
It's also, as depicted here, the Knights in Shining Armor land. Yeah. While we had Last Wall before, that was sort of the protect the defensive crusaders, and we have Mindev, which is the offensive crusaders. This is the land where the people dress up like crusaders, but instead of going and fighting things, they just fight each other for show, so that they can show their own superiority and nobility and reason, you know, justification for dressing up in shiny armor, because You can't just do it for no reason.
They haven't invented Ren Fairs yet.
No, they are. One giant Ren Fair, actually. Yeah.
Can I be a knight?
No.
Can I be in Tal'Dorei?
You can be in Tal'Dorei.
How?
But you can't be a knight.
Mm. What if I wanted
Was your dad a knight?
What if I wanted to say, I can be a knight? Can I make myself king? And say, then now I can be a knight.
You could maybe become a noble, and probably not king.
Okay, how do I do that?
Yeah, well, there's an AP that is just wrapping up, our most recent one, and that is called War for the Crown. I wanted to call it Crownfall, and I'm like, no, that's the first volume. and in that, the king of Tal'Dorei, who's ruled for like 40 years, maybe?
Too long.
Yeah, too long. He's no longer king. And there is a dispute over who should inherit it. And you act as agents of one of those hopefuls, the Princess Eutropia, who is, by Tal'Dorei law, not able to take the throne because she's a woman. And therefore, it should go to her younger brother. But he died. And so the general, who was the chosen successor, says, well, see, I should be king. And you get to help her try and prove that, no, you shouldn't be. So lots of intrigue, lots of spies and sabotage. What?
This last one.
Okay, we have one more? Okay. Yeah, so that's a good thing. And, you know, that's a good AP that it's just wrapping up. And, you know, in the process of that, you'll be able to help reshape who is in charge of one of our core nations.
And then I can be a knight.
And then you can be a knight,
okay.
Yes. All right, one more.
I think this is the last one. Oh, we can go back to the inner sea map.
And then. Yeah, let's go back to the inner sea map. And we're now at about 1:30, so I guess we'll open it up to questions. This would just be any basic questions about the world of Galarian, the setting.
If you have any particular type of game you'd like to run, there's probably a nation we can talk about to
help out with that, asking, you know, what sorts of adventures you're interested in, and we can try and find the place for it, because the kitchen sink is our philosophy on this place. There's a place for every type of adventure. Yeah.
I really like the gods and that sort of religious aspects of Galarian. I use them often to flavor characters or places. I use the inner sea gods and the book about the minor
inner sea faiths. Yeah. Yeah, yes. So the question was, he says that he likes the gods of Galarian and the faiths and uses those to really add depth to characters and stories, and uses the books Inner Sea Gods, which is a hardcover, and Inner Sea Faiths, which is a 128-page softcover, to really flesh out those various faiths, and was asking about what other resources are available for someone who likes that sort of information.
I think Eleanor
knows.
We have
a book for you.
Later this year.
Coming in December?
I
December
think it's earlier
January.
Than that.
Yes, okay, sometime
so
this year.
Anyway, within
months.
The next few months.
We have a new book along the lines of Inner Sea Faiths coming out, which details 10 more of the gods, but from they're lesser known or from different areas of Galarian. Do we want to actually tell them?
Yeah, this is a perfect time to reveal that sort of thing. Yeah,
we've had a few of them, so
yeah.
Okay, so in that book, we're going to have a number of the deities from non-human pantheons, so like the elves, the gnomes, dwarves, and halflings. So that would include Chaldir Azuzistan, who's the good-aligned major halfling god, Nivi Rombodazzle, who is the gnome god of gambling and gems and that sort of thing. Magrim is the
gem and holograms.
Yes.
Yes. She is truly, truly, truly outrageous. Magrim, the dwarven god of death, and Kedifis, the elven god of the hunt. We're also going to be detailing gods outside of the Inner Sea region of Galarian. So there's three deities from Tien Sha. Heifeng, which is a Tengu, which is a giant bird person, god of thunder and storms, who is...
A storm crow.
Yes.
Yeah.
who is very often drunk and may do some things while drunk that he regrets later and that you regret later.
Like we all do.
My town. My cabbages. There's also Shizuru and Sukiyo, who are the two sort of top gods in the Tian Xia pantheon. Shizuru is the sun goddess, Sukiyo is the moon god. And
they're married, right? Or
they're in love.
They've got kind of a non-traditional relationship.
Yeah, but they are among our gods, one of the few
that we've straight
couples
up saved,
that, yeah, like they are romantically involved. So, and then we have more, right?
We have in another area of the world known as Vudra, which is very much inspired by India and other.
Southeast Asian.
South Central Asian, the like, who has a god known as Gruhasa, who is one of the 1,000 gods of Vudra. He is an embodiment of a book known as. I don't know how
to pronounce it.
there's a big holy book in Vudra, and he represents a lot of knowledge and the perfection of knowledge for humanity. And then in Arcadia we have another god from kind of inspired by Mayan and Aztec and all those kind of mythologies known as Kazatal. She is known as Mother Jaguar. She's very much kind of tough war goddess, but also now over time has grown to become a goddess and very much focusing on community and reliance on helping each other. So
now that you've listened to our product spiel, I can tell you about a few other books that might help with
what's
that.
What's that book called?
It's called Face of Galarian. Yes, coming in our campaign setting line very soon.
But there's a few other books that might help you with that. Chronicles of the Righteous has a big section on what we call the Imperial Lords. They're not necessarily big top gods. They're basically like...
They're the angel and archon and so forth, the celestial version of demon lords or archdevils. So that's got a whole book that's all about the Imperial Lords.
And you can worship those, and they will give you power much like a god would. So sort of like lesser deities, if you would.
Demigods.
And there's, of course, the Book of the Damned, which has 5 billion demons. In case you don't want to kill the 6 billion demons, you want to worship one, or two, or five, or seven.
Or one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, or...
Or one of the archdevils.
Or one of the archdevils, yeah.
Do we have a Twitch question?
Okay, so someone looking for an undead fighting campaign, where should they base that in Galarian?
Ustalav is where I think first.
So Ustalav is really our Gothic horror region. It's just at the northern side of this. There's this sea here in the middle of the... you want to zoom in on Ustalav, Sarah?
Okay.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, so just at the north end of Lake Incarthen, which is a major waterway in the center of the northern continent of the Inner Sea region, Avastan, Ustalav is a land where you'd fight werewolves and vampires and undead. That's where the Whispering Tyrant is imprisoned in the southern portion of that, in the Tower of Gallowspire. So that's a great place to do that. We previously published the Carrion Crown Adventure Path, which was largely about the cultists of the group called the Whispering Way, which they want to further the undead cause. They're trying to help the Whispering Tyrant escape, and it's your job to keep them from doing that. And then starting in February, we will have the
Tyrant's Grasp
Adventure Path, which will be our final first edition Adventure Path. And in that one, it begins with the Whispering Tyrant returning. And you get to it's called Tyrant's Grasp. And you get to deal with the fallout of that and try and contain the chaos and death and carnage and undeath and more carnage. So yeah, so those are both full adventure paths that are very undead heavy.
We also have the Nation of Geb.
Oh yeah,
which is a bit further south.
I don't know if you'd want to fight undead there.
Yeah, no, fighting undead is dangerous in a country where all the inhabitants are undead. Geb is named after the wizard Geb, who was a necromancer, and he created a nation which where ghouls and vampires and morgues and just any kind of undead can live there. They keep humans as cattle so that they can, you know, eat dinner whenever they want. And, you know, those who like brains can eat brains. And those who like to suck your blood can do that instead. it's not a great place to be among the living, but it is a place where you could fight undead if you really wanted to go right into the lion's den. A little further north of that, we have Osirian, which is sort of our ancient Egypt analog. So that's where you would fight mummies. That's where you're going to find, you know, zombie hordes sort of rising from the tombs and coming to reclaim their ancient birthright from 10,000 years ago. That's really our undead happy regions, but undead can also be anywhere there's a graveyard. So, yeah. Anything else? Yes, over here.
Galarian is kind of unique in that there are nations with openly evil patron deities, which other countries don't crusade against. Could you speak as to the game function of those?
Okay, so the question was that Galarian is unique in that there are nations that have openly evil patron deities or openly evil heads of state. That other nations do not crusade against, and wondering what the game or I guess narrative function of that is. So among those are Cheliax, which is sort of our infernal empire. This is what you have when a very wealthy, very powerful nation goes into civil war, and because they were going to have Aridin rule them when he came back, and then he didn't. He was late. All the noble families fought, and the one that came out on top did so because they made a pact with the devil. And that gave them the armies of hell on their side, and now that family and all who follow them are indebted to the Asmodeus and they have embraced the darkness, and they so that's sort of the evil tyrannical devil empire. We did have a crusade against them, the Hell's Rebel. Vengeance.
Crusade against them.
Yes, there was the Hell's Rebels adventure path deals with a rebellion in one city of Cheliax, where the people rise up to try and break free of the empire. And then happening concurrently with that is our to date only evil campaign where you play villains, and that's called Hell's Vengeance. And in that, you are working for the Empire, trying to quell an outside crusade coming in to basically dethrone Queen Abigail and establish the Church of Iomedae as the new bosses there. So there's some crusades. We've also got the Nation of Nidal, which is just north of Cheliax. And during the Age of Darkness, when everyone else was...
Panicking,
like they were trying to figure out what they were going to eat when their crops couldn't grow because they got no sun. Nidal made a deal with the god of darkness and shadows and pain. And he's sort of the Cenobite god who's sadomasochistic and likes chain and spikes and blood. And
Shops at Hot Topic,
yeah. So he's a bad dude. His name is Zon Kuthon. And they basically said, look, we'll worship you if you help us get through this time of darkness. And he's like, I love darkness. And so they've been worshiping him ever since. And people don't really attack them because they have a deal with Cheliacs that they'll basically leave each other alone. And no one wants to mess with Cheliacs. So Nadal has sort of... Nadal doesn't really have ambitions of conquest beyond their own borders. So they're just sort of like... If Switzerland was a shadow realm.
More into chains than chocolate.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They're very dirty cuckoo clocks. So no one attacks them because they are largely neutral in the affairs of the world. And then we have, what are the other ones? Geb is one that we just mentioned. No one attacks them because no one really wants to go up against a whole nation of undead. That's a lot of undead.
An army that never tires.
Yes, exactly. That will just raise the living soldiers that they've killed to populate their own armies. It's not a good scene. There was historically a war that lasted generations, hundreds of years, between Geb and his living counterpart, the Arc Wizard or
Arc Lord.
He wasn't an Arc Lord. Arc Lords try and replicate his power.
Another
powerful wizard named Nex, and he has his own nation, which is just north of Geb, to the southwest. There you go.
Named Nex, because it's wizards Nex. Are creative.
Yeah. if you're a wizard who can live for hundreds and hundreds of years and you get to name a nation, why not name it after yourself? Who's going to stop you?
Well, the other wizard.
In their case, it was the other wizard trying to stop them. And they fought for a long, long time, and Geb is now a ghost, and Nex sort of disappeared. No one knows where he went. In between them is the Mana Waste, which is just a magic blasted land where magic doesn't work quite right. Sometimes there's magic dead zones, or there's primal magic that you cast a spell and you get some effect you didn't expect, or it's way more powerful or way weaker, or who knows.
I think to get... to answer more directly to your question.
Yeah, so now that I've established where those places are.
Everything right now is, I'd say, in a really delicate balance. If a nation like Cheliacs, for example, decided, hey, we're tired of Kadira because they worship a good goddess, and decided to start attacking, that would kind of set things in motion where any nation that worships a good god decides, okay, we're going to go against all the evil god nations, and vice versa. So keeping things as they are right now means the world, the entire world, doesn't break into the god wars where everyone fights, you know, anything that's opposed to their own god. So keeping things as they are means that it stays in that kind of standstill where, you know, it could happen at any time, but we know that as soon as we try to, you know, be the first to take action, everything else is going to break out. Kind of for the same reason that's why gods don't directly intervene, as if a god intervenes, then the other gods say, oh, well, if you're doing that, I'm going to show up too, and then everything goes wrong.
The only gods that really intervene are the gods of chaos, because they don't care if the other gods intervene.
And more getting to the what's the purpose narratively. Every campaign setting needs its villains. And in this particular case, they're just a little more fantastical than your standard political, well, these guys are evil because whatever the heck, these guys are worshiping demons because it gives them power. But it's, for one thing, it stops politics at the table, which I think we can all agree you don't really want in the middle of your game necessarily.
You're not going to break into a debate over healthcare when you have a nation of undead that's...
We have a healthcare plan for you.
Zero con. Now you don't have to worry about health.
We'd also rather let you kick off that adventure or
exactly.
that storyline.
To let your PCs be the ones to take down the evil nation instead of reading a novel about it or it happening off stage and you finding out that they did that there.
And it presents a lot of, you know, more story ideas to have this nation that you can't necessarily just walk in and stab everybody responsible, and that fixes the problem. You can't do that. There's like a billion demons over there. A billion devils, sorry. This is the nation of a billion devils, and they're not doing so good against the billion demons, so trying to kill this nation is not the best idea. And you're going to have to really think about what you're willing to let slide, what you're willing to do to survive in a nation that's openly hostile to good people, mm-hmm. what you're willing to sacrifice to try and stop this sort of thing. And those are things that you can't really do if every problem can be solved by just murdering it, which I realize might be blasphemy for some players, but they exist as just the powerful villains that you have to really think about how you want to deal with these people, if you can even deal with these people, and And not all of the people there are necessarily evil. There are lawful neutral Hell Knights.
And there are good people who live in Cheliax and Nadal who are not actively working to forward the goals of their government. They just can't help where they live in the same way that, you go to, in the real world, people go to war with other nations and there's innocent people caught in the middle. And so that's another role of those nations, is to be the places where players need to think about what they're doing. Yeah, so. Yeah. All right, we have time for one more question. We'll go here in black.
Yeah, I was trying to set up a campaign where, primitives, and they run across and go out for more primitive like jungle setting and stuff, and they just they're all no more about the tribe, and as they go outward, they find more and more.
Okay, so someone coming from an isolated
jungle area.
And
they have stone weapons and leather. That's all they have.
Okay, and so a low tech game in the sense that they would have more basic weapons, and then as they adventure, they might discover swords and stuff like that. You can really set you can set that type of game just about anywhere. I mean, the major jungle in our region is in the center of the southern continent, the region called the Mwangi Expanse. But the people who live there are actually very advanced. So you might have better luck with that type of thing in the north, where Numeria or the Realm of the Mammoth Lords, which is adjacent, right there. That's where nomadic tribes, they live in, portable, yurts, exactly. And they follow. That would be more in the Mongol type. Influence would be more in Tian Sha,
the horse
lords that Eleanor was talking about before. But they're definitely the kind that are going to make their weapons from the resources that they find around them. They're hunter gatherers. They don't really make permanent settlements. They're hunting megafauna. Saber-toothed tigers and mammoths and woolly rhinoceroses and there's even an area up there where it's warmer, and they a pocket of warmth that where there's dinosaurs that they can find, and so that might be a better option for that, because the jungle region that we have, the cultures that live there are very high magic, so they were among the first or even the only places to retain their knowledge of magic during the Age of Darkness. There used to be flying cities there that, for whatever reason, have disappeared, or crashed. And so they're not quite as limited in terms of their technological advancement as it sounds like you might want in the jungle itself. But if you really wanted both the jungle setting and, that sort of Quest for Fire style discovery of new innovative technologies, then you could always create your own, group of people in that area and do it there. That's a different direction than we took with our jungle region. So that's really all the time that we've got. Obviously we publish hundreds of pages of new setting material every month. It can seem sort of onerous at times to get into, so I recommend folks look for the Innersea World Guide, which is really the one-shot you know, overview of the setting. We've got that downstairs in the booth, or you can get it online on paizo.com, of course, or just about anywhere. I mean, it's all over the place. That's really our campaign setting core book. I also encourage people to check out pathfinderwiki.com, which is a fan-run resource compiling information from all different Pathfinder sources, our novels, comics, audio dramas, the forthcoming computer game, all of our adventure paths and campaign setting books over the last 11, 12 years. It's where you can find, if not an overview of something you're looking for, at the very least, you know, the name of a book that you might want to go and check out specifically on those topics. So again, that's pathfinderwiki.com. And we're all available on the paizo.com message boards. So if you have specific questions about the setting, you can always ask, and the community is super helpful. And we as Paizo staff are on there frequently, and we can answer those questions for you as well. So I hope everyone has a great time adventuring in Galarian, or if you make your own system, that it provides inspiration for you to, you know, tell similar stories or pick up parts you like and then drop them into your setting and go from there. So thanks again.
Thank you.
And
enjoy the rest of the con.